Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, August 10, 2017. The Foreign Minister of Germany is calling on South Sudanese leaders to resolve the country's conflict through a peaceful means.
It is a good thing that the international community and also the neighboring countries like Uganda support the peace process. However, the peace process can only be successful when it comes from South Sudan itself.
And a youth-led initiative to resolve conflicts says the effort is making a difference.
We came in and started mobilizing youth, getting them on board to talk about the issues that are happening in the country, because we want them to take the ownership of what is happening, to take the ownership of the country and get involved in decision-making.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The German foreign minister is urging South Sudanese leaders to use peaceful means to resolve the ongoing conflict. Signa Gabriel says all stakeholders, including the armed opposition, should be included in efforts to restore peace and stability across South Sudan. Waki Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
The German foreign minister spoke to journalists in Juba today, shortly after meeting with the President Salva Kiir and some of his ministers. Speaking through a translator, Gabriel said the current state of affairs in South Sudan is frustrating the international community.
That is particularly disappointing because there was so much hope after the independence South Sudan gained from Sudan, and also because there has been and there still is a lot of support coming from the international community for the development of South Sudan.
Gabriel says there is no alternative to peaceful solution for ending the conflict in South Sudan. He says neither the government nor the rebels can win the conflict militarily. He praised President Kiir for initiating a national dialogue to address some of the problems facing South Sudan, but stressed that the process must be inclusive to restore peace.
We need to involve and include all stakeholders here, all parties included into this process, and we need to promote the integration of the opposition into this process as well. I think we need to also send important messages of understanding.
At the same news conference, South Sudan Foreign Minister Deng Alor said the president and his ministers discussed a number of issues with Gabriel.
They discussed the national dialogue. They discuss the issue of war and peace in South Sudan. They discuss the issue of humanitarian situation in South Sudan. They discuss the issue of the current situation. They discuss also the issue of revitalization, peace process.
Gabriel advised the foreign diplomats involved in South Sudan's conflict to support the peace process and refrain from supporting one political party over another.
It is a good thing that the international community and also the neighboring countries like Uganda support the peace process. However, the peace process can only be successful when it comes from South Sudan itself.
The German foreign minister's brief visit to Juba comes amid reports of fighting between government and opposition forces in Pagak, a rebel stronghold. On Wednesday, Gabriel visited Uganda, where he met with the government officials. He also traveled to the Ugandan district of Arua, where he met many South Sudanese refugees, many of whom have witnessed the horrors of war and now face reduced UN food rations. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Panelists at a recent discussion at the United States Institute of Peace in Washington say if you are part of a youth-led peace initiative for peace, there is a good chance you will work with little or no resources on matters of peace and security. INBO has more from Washington.
Rachel Walsh Taza is program coordinator in the Children and Youth Division of the nonprofit Search for Common Ground. In her work to end violent conflict around the world, she says she's noticed a trend in youth-led peace initiatives.
These youth-led organizations are primarily driven by volunteers. And what I mean when I say that is 97% of the staff they report are unpaid. And then more than that, around 50% of these youth-led organizations working on critical issues of peace and security Security operate on less than $5,000 a year.
South Sudan native Jacob Bull works with the United States Institute of Peace as part of his extended professional development with the Mandela Washington Fellowship. He told participants he and his colleagues back home operate in complex environments where freedom of expression is restricted. He says many of his colleagues have lost faith in their leaders, who he says have no will to move the country forward. So they created Anataban, which translates to "We are tired" from Arabic. Bull says it has since grown into a national media campaign to bring attention to the consequences of conflict in South Sudan.
We came in and started mobilizing youth and going to different states in the country and getting them on board to talk about the issues that are happening in the country, because we want them to take the ownership of what is happening, to take the ownership of the country and get involved in decision-making, knowing that the biggest population in South Sudan are the youth. They make over 72% of the population. So who is there to make your decision as a youth of that country?
This Saturday is International Youth Day, a day endorsed in 1999 by the United Nations to celebrate young people's contributions to conflict prevention. Imran Abuba, founder of the Youth Coalition Against Terrorism, a youth-led nonprofit in Nigeria, told participants at the USIP discussion this week that successful peace initiatives require youth engagement.
And when I look at the nature of the conflict, most of the victims are young people, and most of the perpetrators are young people at the same time. That is what redefined my vision and inspired me to do something.
And Taza says the very nature of conflict restricts movement, heightens insecurity, and spreads fear.
Despite these limitations, these resource limitations, youth-led organizations are having impact on peace and security in their communities. Not only are they preventing violence, preventing recruitment to violent extremist groups, building social cohesion and interfaith unity, in some places they're also the only organizations who have the access to deliver humanitarian aid where other organizations fail.
On top of that, Taza says youth-led initiatives tend to be gender balanced. The demands of these youth-led campaigns tend to be the same in every country. Young people want to be taken seriously as credible peace builders. They want a voice at the negotiation table, and they want better representation for marginalized communities. Ayan Bior for VOA News, Washington.
South Sudanese refugees in Uganda's Kiriadongo settlement say a poor harvest this season has affected their hope of becoming self-reliant through farming. Simon Peter Apiku has more for VOA from Uganda's Kiriadongo district.
The UN World Food Programme has reduced food rations for refugees who have spent more than a year in the camps. To compensate for the food shortages, the refugees were hoping to produce enough food this season to feed their families and sell any surplus produce so they could buy other essential commodities and services. But a brief dry spell at the beginning of this year's farming season and the arrival of the notorious armyworm, which has destroyed crops in much of neighboring Uganda, is dashing those hopes. Joseph Lemini is a South Sudanese refugee who fled his country about a year ago.
Some of the crops planted failed because there has been a lot of destructive worms that destroy maize, destroy even some cassava. The groundnuts planted fail.
Lemin, a trained teacher, says he has tried farming after failing to get a job as a teacher in one of the camp's schools. Ivan Stibi, who fled South Sudan after violence broke out in Juba in the beginning of the conflict in late 2013, says he has been struggling to earn a living since settling in the Kiriadongo camp. He says over the past few years, he was able to raise enough money to rent several acres of land for farming. But Tibi says this season has been one of the worst on record.
I planted 2 acres of beans, but I've not got anything good out of this, simply because of the drought spell. The crops failed. The same thing happened to maize. I planted about 10 acres, and I've never got meaningful yield out of these 10 acres.
Martina Lagua, also a refugee, says she invested a lot of time and energy in her crops and got very little yield in return. She says in a good season, an acre of land usually yields 10 to 15 bags of maize, each weighing about 100 kilograms.
So the production for this year, I got it very low. And compared to last year I got it a bit fair. I cultivated 4 acres. I got about 32 bags. But this year I got it only, I got 27, which is very low because of the worms.
Legua, whose husband was murdered by Sudanese forces during the 1992 purges of South Sudanese authorities, says most refugees cannot afford to buy pesticides to control the armyworms, so they ravaged their crops. People who planted crops early on in the season, such as Yei River State refugee Santos Peter, had a fairly good harvest. Peter says he was just lucky.
This season I was able to cultivate 1 acre of land and I was able to get around 9 sacks of maize. That is 100 kilos.
Unlike TB and Lagua, Peter did not have to rent the land. He was given a plot of land to live on and an additional acre of land for farming, which is rare for refugees. TB says refugees interested in farming must often make their own arrangements with members of the host community.
What people do here is you go to the natives, you talk to them, you hire land from them, then you plant. Land here is hired per season.
Kiryadongo district is one of the best places in Uganda to plant maize, as there are 2 planting seasons a year. Lemin says planting maize or beans is beneficial in this area.
The Kiryadongo district is a food basket for Uganda. Many people come and buy maize here because maize produces a lot in this district.
Legua says despite this season's poor harvests, she hopes to sell part of her produce and use the money for other needs.
The money is actually for helping the children in school, for medication, for changing our diet, and also the ration have been cut down, so it also helps us to add our feeding.
Donors have praised what they say is Uganda's progressive policies that allow refugees to move freely about the country to work and own land for various purposes, including farming, because it helps them become more self-reliant. For VOA News, I'm Simon Peter Piku in Kiryadongo District.
A comprehensive new study finds RDTS, or rapid diagnostic tests for malaria, are reducing the overuse of malaria medications. But researchers at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine also found some surprising results. They analyzed 500,000 patient visits across malaria-prone regions of Africa and Afghanistan and found many patients were being given malaria drugs despite testing negative for malaria. Dr. Heidi Hopkins, a researcher who helped conduct the study, tells VOA's Kim Lewis there were positive findings.
This was an analysis of data from 10 different studies that were designed in a harmonized way. And those studies were conducted by an international team of collaborators across several African countries and also one Asian country, Afghanistan. In all of these studies, rapid diagnostic tests for malaria were implemented in different settings, in public health facilities, in community health worker environments, in private clinics. The overall finding was that RDTs do help us appropriately and safely reduce the use of antimalarial medicines, in particular artemisinin and combination therapies.
At the same time, you all did make some other findings, some that were maybe surprises or concerns that you found in your study.
That's right. So in addition to the positive impact in terms of appropriately reducing the overuse of antimalarials, we also found 2 things in particular that surprised us and that were less desirable. Number one, we found that when patients didn't get an antimalarial because their test was negative, instead the clinicians or the providers often gave an antibiotic. Sometimes that may be appropriate, but not always, and it's a challenge because that now is going to contribute to antibiotic resistance, bacterial resistance, if we begin to overuse antibiotics instead of overusing antimalarials. The second thing we found that was surprising was that a large proportion, even up to 20% in some cases, of patients who tested positive for malaria were not given an ACT or were not given an antimalaria at all.
So then where where do you all go from here? What is your next step?
We'd like to understand more about why providers are making these decisions. Of course, it's not just the technology. If you just put in a rapid diagnostic test in place, that doesn't solve all the problems. The healthcare providers need to understand how the tests work. And more importantly, they need to know what to do when the malaria test is negative. In many parts of the world, no matter how much training you have, no matter how much capacity you have, it's very challenging to determine what's causing a case of fever if it's not malaria. And we need to do better at getting the evidence and teaching the providers and ourselves what to do when a malaria test is negative.
Why is it such a challenge to treat malaria?
Malaria is not that hard to treat. If you've got a blood test that's showing that a patient has malaria and you have the appropriate medicine, which in most parts of the world now is an artemisinin combination therapy or ACT, if you can get the good quality drug to the patient and the patient can take it appropriately, that malaria will be gone. It's not that hard to treat malaria.
Why is it that some people who were diagnosed with malaria, they did not receive the treatment?
We have the same question. We don't have evidence to explain that clearly because we didn't expect that result and therefore we didn't go looking for the reason. I can maybe speculate, having spent a lot of years in different African settings myself and watched how health workers work, I could suppose that even if there was not a shortage of drugs in these study sites, people who are used to working in settings where there are drug shortages, where there are stockouts, people run out of medicine, maybe they have a way of thinking that they want to conserve the medicines they do have, maybe for sicker patients, maybe for somebody who's less able to go and buy separately. So I'm just speculating. We don't have any evidence to support that, but that's one reason that comes to mind when we think about why this might have happened.
And also in looking at those people who tested negative and still were receiving some type of medicine, even antibiotics, what would you think the mindset be for that?
I think when you're working in a low-resource setting and you know that some of your patients are coming from quite a distance away, people come from several kilometers away walking or on a motorcycle, you're reluctant to send them home without something powerful. And people think of antimalarials or antibiotics or certain types of medicines as powerful. And if you don't have a clear diagnosis, still want to do something, the patient wants something, even if the health worker feels like he or she could send the patient home just with some Panadol or paracetamol and fluids, the patient may insist or the parent may insist. And so there's a number of different things that work together to give the outcome.
That's Dr. Heidi Hopkins of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. She was speaking to VOA's Kim Lewis from Uganda. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, election observers speak out about Kenya's election. We'll bring details when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
are you at your best in the morning or later in the day?
Well, it's later on in the day. I start off the morning really slow, but then as time goes on, I get more energized and I concentrate more on what I'm doing.
In the morning, my brain is fresh and I can easily understand everything. I can easily think. Then in the evening, I'm also good because of the clubs. I am sure of going to the club and have some happiness. Yeah.
In the morning, I wake up early. I can do a whole day job in the morning. In the afternoon, I want to relax and stuff like that.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. The results of Kenya's presidential election are expected Friday. The Electoral Commission says it is still waiting to receive the official signed forms from all the country's polling stations to ensure they match the electronic results previously transmitted. The opposition continues to dispute the results so far. VOA's Jill Craig has the latest.
Kenyans are still waiting to learn the outcome of Tuesday's presidential poll pitting incumbent Uhuru Kenyatta against opposition leader Raila Odinga. As of Thursday afternoon, election officials were waiting to receive about 170 forms from the country's 290 constituencies and about 1,000 forms from the 40,883 polling stations. The chairman of Kenya's Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, Wafula Chebukati, said Thursday, "We are now in the final stretch.
All the presidential results from returning officers
to reach the National Sailing Center by 12 p.m. tomorrow, that is the 11th of August.
The expectation is that the announcement of the winner will be made soon thereafter. Provisional tallies released by the Electoral Commission so far show Kenyatta with a 9-point lead on Odinga. However, the opposition is rejecting those results as fraudulent, saying the Electoral Commission's computer networks were hacked. On Thursday, the Electoral Commission chief confirmed that there was an attempt to hack the system after the vote, but he said that attempt failed. The opposition says its calculations show Odinga beating Kenyatta by a margin of more than 600,000 votes. The leader of the opposition NASA coalition, Musalia Mudavadi, spoke to reporters Thursday.
We demand that the IBC chairperson announce the presidential election results forthwith and declare the Right Honorable Raila Amolo Odinga as the duly elected president of the Republic of Kenya.
There have been pockets of unrest in the country, like in Kisumu, as well as Mathare and Kibera slums in Nairobi, where burned tires have been smoldering in the road since Wednesday. But Kibera resident George Omondi Otieno says that no matter the outcome, people need to resist violence.
Even if I'm celebrating, let me celebrate in a way that may not provoke the other person, because if I celebrate in a way that provokes the other person, that escalates that feeling, and that may end up people fighting, of which we don't want.
And as the Electoral Commission finalizes its work, the country continues to wait. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
International election observer missions have given Kenya's nationwide vote passing grades. Lenny Ruvaga reports for VOA from Nairobi.
International election observers called for restraint Thursday as Kenyans await the announcement of the official results from the nationwide polls. Tensions have risen as the opposition alleges foul play, saying the voting system was hacked in favor of the incumbent President Uhuru Kenyatta. Former U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry led the election observation mission from the U.S.-based Carter Center alongside former Senegalese Prime Minister Aminata Touré. Kerry urged Kenyans to follow due process in challenging any results, including the allegations of hacking.
Nobody should dismiss anything out of hand. It needs to be examined. It needs to be judged whether or not, if it did happen, there was any material impact on the election itself. And we have to get to the bottom of that. But there's a way to do that. And what we're arguing is that people need to adhere to the legitimate process for following up on this.
The Carter Center, along with observation missions from the U.S.-based National Democratic Institute, the African Union, the Commonwealth, and the European Union, said the voting on Tuesday appears to have been open and credible. Former South African President Thabo Mbeki led the AU mission, which sent 43 teams of observers to 400 polling stations around the country.
The people were permitted to vote in a manner which met the standards set in Kenya law, which was also consistent with the policies of the African Union. And similarly, the process of counting the votes at the polling stations was done in a transparent manner, with the participation of the agents of the political parties. Accordingly, we can say that the processes, as we were able to observe, up to and including the counting of the votes at the polling stations and their transmission to the IEBC and so on, met the standards set by Kenya and the AU for the conduct of democratic elections.
The European Union Observation Mission said it has seen no signs of manipulation of the process. However, Chief EU Observer Maria Cheshake told VOA their analysis is ongoing.
Results are still coming in. And of course, the key question is always, were elections free or fair? But we look much more comprehensively at the entire election process, the campaign, election day, what happens afterwards. And we're going to reflect in more detail on what we see. So these are not the kinds of terms that we use, and we're still in the middle of assessing how things went. On election day itself, people were waiting patiently, casting their votes, and generally the procedures were followed according to Kenyan law on election day. But election day is one chapter in a longer electoral process.
Kenyans cast their ballots in presidential, parliamentary, and local elections. The constitution gives the IEBC a period of 7 days to officially declare winners of all contested electoral seats. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
From Nairobi, we move to the Central African Republic, where the International Red Cross and Red Crescent movements condemns the killing of six Red Cross volunteers by unidentified armed men in the conflict-ridden Central African Republic. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Red Cross headquarters in Geneva.
Red Cross officials say they are shocked and saddened by the killing of their six colleagues, all local Red Cross volunteers. Little is known about the circumstances surrounding these deaths. The attack took place on August 3rd in Gambo in Southeast Central African Republic, an area on the border with Democratic Republic of Congo. Because of its remoteness, several days elapsed before information about these violent deaths surfaced. A spokeswoman for the International Committee of the Red Cross, Aurélie Lachant, tells VOA the volunteers were taking part in a crisis meeting at a health facility in Gambo when unidentified gunmen stormed in and began shooting people. She says about 50 civilians and medical personnel, including the six Red Cross volunteers, were killed.
Because of this violence and the fact that some humanitarians are affected by this means that the population who is in need of humanitarian assistance, it will be difficult to assist the population in such circumstances. So it makes the work of humanitarian workers more difficult to assist populations in need.
The civil war between the predominantly Muslim Seleka and Christian anti-Balaka militia, which has been going on since 2013, is worsening. A senior UN official recently warned of early signs of genocide. Lachance says this attack is the third such incident in 1 year in which Red Cross volunteers have been killed. She says the Red Cross will not suspend its activities, though the agency will observe 3 days of mourning in honor of its slain colleagues. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
That's our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song Harami by CJ Oman.
What's up?
We have been listening to CJ Oman with the song Harami. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We appreciate you joining us today. We'd like to hear what you think about this show. Our email is southsudan@voanews.com. Or you can check us on our Facebook page, South Sudan in Focus. Tune in again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
You say nothing about me. I don't give a none. It's my right to tell you this, and it's my right to tell you the truth. And if you hate me, kill me. It's my destiny to die for the youth.